Your conference is being recorded.
Good morning, everyone. This is Josh Gross, CEO of Mill Creek Capital Advisors. I just want to say thank you for joining us for today's quarterly markets phone call. We want to thank everyone that has joined in. And if you listen to this tonight or at a later time, anyone, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us, and we look forward to trying to be as informative as we can. So, as in the past, our objective with this call is to provide an update on the major development in global capital markets across the just completed quarter. And as you can guess, last quarter, which really December, really had a rapid decline in the markets, and then the first quarter of 2019 has more than made up for the decline in December. So while point to point, it looks, if you looked at 4 month returns, like, boy, not a lot's happening, the volatility has actually been fairly high over the last 3-4 months. As well, the Fed announced that it would curtail its 3-year program to raise U.S. interest rates, and that boosted bond markets, which have had outsized gains, and also triggered a rally in U.S. and global stock markets, which have more than offset the December's decline. So we're going to try and cover all of this over the next 30 minutes. And then, you know, just one quick note that, you know, I would expect that most of the people listening to the call, either live or listening to this as a recording later, may already be familiar with Mill Creek. And for those that are just getting to know us, this is one of the ways these quarterly phone calls and our written quarterly updates from the investment strategy team are ways that we want to routinely communicate with clients outside of our quarterly in-person meetings that we like to do with all of our clients. And we've tried to distinguish ourselves by providing these timely insights and perspective on what we're seeing in the capital markets. So thank you again for listening to this and for your confidence in our team. So I'll introduce today's speakers in the order that they'll be talking this morning. Tom Chapin, as you all know, Mill Creek's founding chief investment officer. Sam McFall, vice president of investments, who has primary responsibilities for global equity markets, strategies, and managers. And then Nora Pickens, who is our VP of investments, and her primary responsibilities are for global fixed income strategies and managers, and being able to discuss the fixed income and debt markets. Tom, we'll go to you first. It was a short 3 months ago that you and the investment strategy team twice found yourself writing to clients about turbulence in the U.S. and global stock markets in the midst of 20% market decline. Probably the first time in several years that you've had to reach out to clients twice within such a short period of time. And, you know, as we say, what an amazing difference, you know, a quarter can make for within a whole year. Why don't you start off today's conversation by giving us a 30,000-foot view on what's going on in the economy and global markets?
Sure. Thanks, Josh, and thanks to everyone as well from me for dialing in to join us today on the call. As in the past, we'll be referring to information on slides that were sent out in advance of the call, so I hope you might have them to refer to. So, yes, we rarely write within a quarter to update clients about good news, and maybe we should start doing that. So as shown on page 2 of these slides, the first quarter of 2019, as you've just said, was exceptionally good. It was as exceptionally good for most investors as it was exceptionally bad in the fourth quarter of 2018. Recall that 2018 started off very strongly, but after a late January, early February correction of about 10%, it took the U.S. stock market until August to break back into positive territory. But looking back at all of 2018, the U.S. economy continued to expand, especially during the second and third quarters of the year, and ended up producing the best annual rate of growth, about up 2.9% since 2015. The U.S. Federal Reserve had hiked short-term interest rates 4 times during 2015, the last time in December to a rate of 2.5%, and had avowed that it would likely to continue to do so in the year ahead. But looking back, the capital market's reaction to the Fed's repositioning was unfavorable, to put it mildly. The markets became concerned that higher rates would not just slow the economy, but end the economic expansion that had begun in mid-2019. And we got that 20% decline for U.S. stocks through Christmas Eve that Josh talked about earlier. Now, Sam and Nora will be providing some more perspectives on the market events and outcomes that produced the very strong quarterly returns for the first quarter. I guess suffice it to say that neither we, nor to our knowledge, any other investment professionals were projecting 10% and higher quarterly returns to kick off 2019, or even returns of this size for the entire year, given some of the economic headwinds as the year got underway. So the precipitating event for such a 180-degree in markets 180-degree turn in markets was the Fed's about-face on monetary policies, and I know Nora will probably talk at great length about this in a little bit. In January, the Fed said it would be patient before raising rates again, and in March it indicated that no additional rate hikes would take place over the balance of 2019. And as we wrote to our clients in the quarterly perspectives letter, which we distributed last week and which is available on our website, it's really rare that a single development will so dramatically alter the trajectory of bond and stock prices. But this is the kind of surprise, I think, that's a welcome surprise for markets. So we frequently counsel investors to keep these short-term outcomes in perspective. So while 10% to 14% quarterly returns are stunning, they look a little less robust when viewed with a 12-month perspective. Josh talked about that earlier as well. Slide 3 shows that the recent rallies only succeeded in pushing U.S. stock market prices about 5% higher than they were a year ago in March of 2018. You can see that bond market outcomes have been comparatively stable, which is generally what would be expected. Note, though, on the chart you can see the relatively strong returns from December onward, first in a flight to safety rally as the stock market crashed 20%, then in response to the recent changes in Fed policy. So taxable and tax-exempt muni bonds both enjoyed 12-month returns that have far exceeded expectations given low interest rates and expectations that yields might actually move higher. Lastly, before I turn it over to Sam, slide 4 provides perspectives on longer-term returns, which is, again, something we think investors should focus on. In this case, we're showing 3-year annualized returns through the end of the first quarter, and you can see that taking risks, particularly by investing in U.S. stocks, has been particularly rewarding across this most recent period. And indeed, since the economy and the stock market bottomed 10 years ago in 2009. Bonds, by way of comparison, have underperformed long-term averages, a not surprising result given the record low levels to which interest rates had fallen through late 2016. But in case some investors were wondering why they own such low-returning assets in a diversified portfolio, bonds did provide a useful reminder by acting as a buffer against the market's sharp downturn last year.
So we'll turn our direction to Sam, whose particular focus is on understanding what's going on in the U.S. and non-U.S. equity markets. Sam, can you provide us a little more color on what was so different about last quarter and this quarter, and then share perspectives on what you think you might see across the balance of 2019?
Sure. Thanks, Josh. We'll take that in a couple parts. So as Tom mentioned, the quarter for global equities was exceptionally good, finishing up over 12%. I think when you look back over the last few quarters, there have really been, in my mind, three drivers pushing equity prices around. You have central bank policy, the U.S.-China trade war or trade tensions, and earnings. And so, the differences that we've seen certainly here in the first quarter versus last year, it's kind of been a total reversal of sorts. So central bank policy in 2018 was you had the Fed hiking 4 times. This year we've seen Fed Chairman Powell pivot and be patient going forward. The U.S.-China trade war, was again a frequent headline in 2018. Got investors skittish and sentiment really turned sour, and the Chinese market sold off quite heavily. You look forward to 2019, and it seems that at least from a political perspective, President Xi and President Trump are motivated to get something done. Whether that's going to be materially impactful remains to be seen, but at least from a political perspective, there seems to be some optimism that something will get done. And then in terms of earnings, last year we had really robust earnings growth where tax reform, corporate tax reform provided a real boost to corporate bottom line. And this year, the earnings outlook isn't quite as good. So you've really had, prices and earnings have a bit of a disconnect, and we continue to be driven, at least in the short run here, by macro headlines and investor sentiment. If we disaggregate, the world into U.S. equities, developed equities, and emerging market equities, it was pretty much a strong quarter across the board with a continued leadership from the U.S., and that's really been the case for a number of years here as the Fed and central banks here have been kind of the global leader in getting us through the financial crisis. So as I mentioned on January 4th, Powell indicated he'd be patient. And that accommodative policy was well received by markets. And then furthermore, in March, he announced that, the balance sheet runoff would end in September. So once again, we have what seems to be a market that, at least in the short run, is being largely driven by central bank policy. And some of the weakness that we've seen in the Eurozone is resulting in some accommodation from the ECB. The Bank of Japan continues to be supportive of their markets as well. I think the dovish pivot that we saw in January really spurred on risk-taking across asset classes. Nora will get into bonds and credit, but equity certainly moved considerably higher. You had strong, the IPO activity remained strong. Investors bid up the prices of almost everything, but we really saw strong performance amongst high-quality companies. And small cap companies, and that came at the expense of more defensive sectors and value stocks. But Tom looked back, over the trailing 12 months, and we look back over the last 6 months, and value stocks still provide a ballast in an equity portfolio, and actually value stocks have outperformed growth stocks over the trailing 6 months. So we still think that they play a role in a portfolio. Outside the U.S., absolute returns were really great, 10%. We take that any quarter. But again, people are comparing the U.S. to the rest of the world. And so there are certainly some macro risks and challenges in the developed world. I already mentioned the Eurozone weakness. You have Germany that's teetering. Italy's in a recession. Japan has ties, at least in the corporate world, ties to global economic growth, and people got a little spooked by global economic growth and what that impact could be to earnings in Japan. Commodities rallied in the quarter, and that benefits countries like Canada and Australia in the short run, but those tend to be areas of the market where we will be structurally underweight, just given our inability to accurately predict commodity prices. Emerging market equities were buoyed by Chinese stocks. As I mentioned already, the China trade deal and sort of the optimism around getting that done some point this year really drove prices higher, both in the H-share and the A-share, local A-share market. And interestingly, just a little factoid, the MSCI, sort of a global leader in benchmark construction, announced that they would quadruple China A-share exposure in the EM benchmark. And so China's going to be at roughly 35% of the benchmark. So, as we go into the quarters and years ahead, China is going to continue to be influential in the global capital markets. And they were really the driver of EM performance in the first quarter. In terms of what we look for the rest of the year, I think when we look at things like the Fed model, which looks at earnings, the earnings yield in the S&P 500 versus the 10-year Treasury, when we look at the equity risk premium, I think investors are still being paid, on a relative basis, being paid to own equities over fixed income. Nora might differ on that perspective, but we shall see. But with the strong move in equity prices here, we have seen valuations pushed out into the sort of 17, 18 times range where you're at fair value in the U.S. And by some metrics, the market's expensive. So I would just caution investors to have sort of more muted expectations on a forward-looking basis. But in the short run, we know sentiment drives returns. And another interesting fact that came up more recently is that since 1990, when you've had a strong quarter like this where you've had a double-digit print, you tended to have a strong year overall, so I wouldn't be surprised to see in the short run here if the U.S. continues to be a leader. With that said, and not trying to sound like a broken record, we here at Mill Creek continue to see value in international equities and like international equities sort of over the next market cycle. But U.S. momentum is pretty strong at this point, admittedly. And in terms of risk to our outlook, I would kind of go back to, you know, the three things I mentioned in the beginning, central bank policy, U.S., China, and earnings. In terms of central bank policy, any misstep, you know, by the Fed, whether they have to change course again, or other action in the future by other central banks could certainly seem to derail market participants in the short run. In terms of U.S.-China, I think a lot of the upside's probably been priced in the stocks at this point, so to me the risk is to the downside. We'll see what happens there. And then the earnings outlook is not particularly great. And, you know, as long-term investors, prices are ultimately driven by earnings growth, and you know, we could have a little bit of a hiccup here. The first half doesn't look great this year, but the back half, there's still a little bit of optimism. So that all remains to be seen. So those are the three biggest risks to our outlook for the rest of the year.
Thank you. All right. We will shift spotlight to Nora. And with the background of the bond market was a very strong place to have invested during last year's equity market meltdown. And then the bond market, high yield and otherwise, and core fixed income has continued to perform very strongly during the first quarter of 2019. So maybe you can provide us with some of the insights into the municipal and taxable bond markets and give us your perspective on what you think is coming ahead in 2019.
Sure. Thank you, Josh. Good morning, everyone. So I'll start with the taxable market, which, as Tom and Josh just alluded to, had really a great start to the year. The sector returned 2.9% through March, which was its best quarterly performance since the third quarter of 2009. At this rate, so just to put it in perspective, you could expect to achieve total returns north of 6% in 2019 if yields and spreads simply held steady for the remainder of the year. So quite attractive given where we've seen, as Tom mentioned, yields play out over the past couple of years. So we take a look back on the quarter, fixed income markets really took off starting March 20th. This was when the Fed, as we've mentioned, kept rates unchanged, which was expected by the market, but ended up surprising everyone by messaging no further rate hikes in 2019 and calling for the end of its balance sheet runoff come September. So in response to the Fed's pivot, Treasuries rallied across the curve with the benchmark 10-year Treasury yield falling 17 basis points over the course of 3 days, and ending the month at 2.41%. This is nearly 85 basis points below the 7-year high hit back in November and has resulted in long-dated treasuries achieving equity-like returns of 13% since that time. Another noteworthy event triggered by the Fed was the brief inversion of the 10-year 3-month segment of the yield curve. The spread turned negative for 5 consecutive days before widening again and moving back above zero. So if you look at slide 6, the top right-hand chart here, you can see this transition as approaching the Fed meeting, and then all of a sudden you see the relationship turn negative and then bounce back above the zero line. Meanwhile, you might also notice that the much-watched 10 to 2-year spread never fell below positive 12 basis points, and today still remains comparatively wide at plus 16 bips. So we're hesitant to draw any definitive conclusions around what the shape of the yield curve might imply about future growth, but we would just highlight that both the 10-year to 3-month spread and the 10-year to 2-year spread inverted before each of the last 4 recessions going back to 1981. Relatedly, there are also few signs of distress in the credit markets today. Investment-grade bonds returned 5.1% through March, which was the sector's third-best quarterly performance over the past 20 years. And spreads are currently trading at 116 basis points above Treasuries, which is well below long-term averages. Furthermore, the trailing 12-month default rate for high-yield bonds ticked below 1% this quarter through March, but remains roughly 55 basis points greater than the all-time low hit back in December 2000 of 0.38%. Now, briefly turning to the tax-exempt market, munis also performed very well. They returned 2.2% this quarter. Apart from falling Treasury yields, which I mentioned earlier, very strong investor demand, as evidenced by record inflows into muni bond funds this quarter, helped push yields lower. With tax season in full swing, it makes sense that investors are turning to munis for their tax-sheltered income to counter the new cap on state and local tax deductions, otherwise known as SALT. So with supply roughly unchanged and muni bonds are trading rich versus historical averages, which is what we try to illustrate again in the bottom right-hand chart on this slide. So if you take, for example, the 10-year muni to treasury ratio, you can see it's currently at 77%, which is just over 1.5 standard deviations below long-term averages, or at a level generally reached only 5% of the time. So these rich valuations imply the additional upside from muni bonds may be hard to come by should treasury yields hover around today's levels. Josh, I'll turn it back to you.
Good. Well, thank you. Tom, point again towards you and state that you're on record as having described the capital markets as having been remarkable in 2017 and then manic in 2018. What is your adjective for the year to describe 2019?
Well, I'm tempted to say wonderful. Or to quote what we wrote in our first quarter perspective piece, that stock market returns were stunning. But I guess with 9 months to go, still to go in the current year, at this point, it may be a little bit premature to attach a label to all of 2019. But to sort of transition beyond that, you know, beyond the last 6 months of returns to 3 months, we find ourselves just having passed the 10-year anniversary of the stock market recession, the recession era low watermark for stock, and we're on track to achieve record 10-year economic expansion as of mid-year. And these anniversaries have given us an opportunity to reflect back on the last decade, which we did in our quarterly perspectives piece as well. We reminded readers, not to shock them, but just how dire things looked back in March of 2019, shortly after the U.S. stock market had fallen 55% from its highs of 2007. And you'll recall at the time that there were very real concerns that the private banking system might not survive what was then, what later became labeled as the Great Recession. And as we all know now, that proved not to be the case. And like the proverbial phoenix rising from the ashes, the $20.5 trillion U.S. economy today is more than 20% larger than it was at the end of 2009. And with a current unemployment rate of 3.9%, that's down from a peak of nearly 10%, that means that about 20 million more people are employed now in comparison to a decade ago. So more jobs, lower interest rates, and home prices that have lifted consumer confidence, in a word, a dramatic turnaround. So for perspective, we put together slide 7 that incorporates not just this 10-year period, but also the 5 years that preceded it to illustrate the somewhat loose relationship that exists between U.S. economic growth and the key drivers of corporate profits and shareholder returns. It shows that the U.S. economy, net of this Great Recession and the subsequent long, slow comeback, has produced real growth of about 2% per year across the last 15 years, and nominal growth adjusted for increases in prices of about 4%. Overall corporate profits measured by the U.S. Government Bureau of Economic Analysis, which includes the overall earnings of private and public companies, have not grown a whole lot faster than the nominal rate of growth of the economy. And that's a relationship between the economy and overall profits that's been fairly consistent across long periods of time. But if you look only at publicly traded corporations, the columns at right on the top of the slide show how sales and operating income, what they earn before taxes, interest payments, depreciation, amortization, also tracks the overall rate of economic growth. But the consequence of lower interest rates, recent tax law changes, and an evolution of the stock market companies away from capital-intensive industries towards service and technology companies, and importantly, share buybacks. As a result of that, earnings per share have collectively grown a lot more quickly than the economy itself. And the rate at which companies have distributed their higher earnings to shareholders in the form of cash dividends has also risen dramatically. As we highlighted in recent research paper, Spending from Portfolios, the income on a portfolio comprised of stocks more than doubled between 2009 and 2019. And that happened at a time when the income on taxable bond portfolios declined by about 40%, with interest rates having fallen off so dramatically. So to summarize, and maybe to pick a word that maybe will come back at the end of this year, a lot of drama and dramatic outcomes across the past decade and for 2019 so far.
So you were fairly optimistic about the outlook for equities generally and U.S. stocks in particular 3 months ago. And one of the things that we talked about was price-to-earnings ratio fell during December to as low as 14.3 times earnings, which made them attractive for investors with a long-term horizon. So if we fast forward today in April, how are you feeling about stocks today, given valuations have now risen again to about 17?
Sure. As Sam has just said, and I'll echo what he just said, we're somewhat more cautious about near-term stock market outcomes, given current valuations, which are up about 22% so far this year. And again, to echo what he said, there's some uncertainty about whether U.S. companies can achieve the market's earnings expectations for all of 2019, particularly across the second half of the year. There's so much unknown about where we go with the economy at this point in the year. And probably the bond market's best months are probably behind it for the year. It's been, as Nora has said, a great start to the year. And if we just earn the coupon yields across the balance of this year, it will be a great year for the bond market. But the only reason the bond could go much higher would be for interest rates to fall off. That would suggest that not good things are going on with the economy, which would not be a good outcome for the U.S. stock market. But to put on my sort of longer-term macro hat, it would seem an economic downturn is likely at some point, although not entirely inevitable. Just because we've been in a recovery for 10 years doesn't mean we're going to have a recession. You know, Australia, for example, is in the midst of a 28-year-long economic expansion for entirely unique reasons, but it's an example nonetheless that a long-term expansion that doesn't provide widespread excesses can continue. So at this point, we anticipate that the next downturn won't be as severe as either the 2008-2009 or the 2001 recessions. So based on our proprietary estimates of future U.S. and global economic growth, our projections of future inflation and interest rates, we think that annualized earnings growth of around 6% or so is readily achievable across the next decade. I don't know if that'll happen next year or the following year, but again, across a long period of time, we think that's achievable. Combining that kind of earnings growth with related growth in cash dividends to shareholders and valuations that perhaps trend somewhat lower on balance, we show on the bottom of slide 7, a table, that it's reasonable to expect annualized returns in the range of 6 to 8%, say, across the next 10 years. So certainly lower returns than those of the past quarter, the past 3 years, and of the last decade, but far from disastrous for investors.
Well, thank you again, and thanks, Tom, Nora, and Sam. We hope that those of you who called in today or who may be calling in later to listen to the recording of the call at a more convenient time. We hope that you've been able to gain a better understanding of some of the key issues and how Mill Creek is focused on them and how they'll be affecting the global capital markets during 2019. If you have any questions, please don't hesitate to reach out to us directly, to your investment team, or to Tom Chapin directly, because we are here to serve you. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you next quarter.